film first crawled across the screen in 2015. Paul Rudd played Scott Lang, who put on what he thought was a motorcycle suit and wound up as Ant-Man, able to shrink down to bug size and fight bad guys.
Now, in Ant-Man and the Wasp, he's joining with Hope Van Dyne, played by Evangeline Lilly, who has a bug suit of her own.
Also starring in the film are Walton Goggins, Michelle Pfeiffer, Lawrence Fishburne, Michael Peña, and again, Michael Douglas as scientist Hank Pym.
If you found the painful sacrifices of recent superhero movies a lot to take, this one is bound to be lighter. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're going big and small with Ant-Man and the Wasp on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair is writer Chris Klimek, one of our favorite superhero conversationalists. How are you doing, Chris?
Shazam. I mean, hi, Linda.
Oh, good, good, good. That's what I like to hear. So I want to go to Glenn first. We all reviewed Ant-Man. We had a conversation about Ant-Man when that first film came out. We liked it, particularly in light of the rather heavy and serious superhero films coming out at the time. What did you think of Ant-Man and the Wasp?
It was fine. Uh-huh. It was just fine. And I have a strong feeling that that's probably what they're aiming for. And they nailed it. It's fine.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great little set pieces. You've seen many of those set pieces in the trailer, unfortunately. I have lots of little nitpicks, so it's going to sound like I'm more down on this film than I am.
Yeah.
I don't think the villain character of Ghost works pretty much at all.
Yeah.
But I noticed something different in tone about this one than the first one, and I have some theories about that, but let's hear from some other folks.
All right. Chris Klimek, what did you think of Ant-Man and the Wasp?
Yeah, well, of course, I'm the Nolan guy. I'm the guy who loves The Dark Knight and Logan and, you know, movies in the genre that lean hard in one direction. And yeah, this one is genial. It's affable. It's agreeable. It's so good and inoffensive that I almost hate it.
Yeah.
And that's not fair. Like, the Marvel machine is so slick now, so well-polished, that they don't really let very many Thors The Dark World get through. I'm not sure I pluralized that correctly.
Yeah.
or indeed that I saw that movie. But, you know, it's the worst kind of one to talk about because it's pretty good.
Yeah. All right. So tell me, Stephen Thompson, Ant-Man reaction.
Okay.
I don't mean Stephen Thompson is an Ant-Man reaction.
No, Stephen Thompson, comma Ant-Man.
Ant-Man reaction. I loved the first Ant-Man. I really appreciated not only the lightness of it and the lower stakes. So many of these Marvel movies are about, will half the universe die? Mm. Ant-Man was, as someone has already used the word, genial. I appreciated that. I appreciated the weird perspective on the fight scenes. The fight scenes looked unlike fight scenes I had seen in movies before, so it didn't feel quite as kind of thuddingly familiar and forgettable as sometimes these movies are for me. This one has those things. It has the geniality. It has some really neat use of perspective. There's a nifty car chase where the cars kind of expand and shrink at opportune times. There are lots of fight scenes where the quick transitions from big to small to huge to small. That stuff I really enjoy, but I also found myself forgetting this movie as I was watching it. And in a way, like, the low stakes of it coming after, like, Avengers Infinity War, this really feels like a B-side in a lot of ways, even though I kind of found myself, as I was watching it, still enjoying it.
As I said, when we talked about the first Ant-Man, one of the contexts for it was how heavy superhero films felt at that time. I think you can say that is, to a certain degree, even more true now, particularly coming off of Infinity War. However, you also just had Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah. And Spider-Man Homecoming.
So Ant-Man, for being a light Marvel movie, is not quite as unusual as it was at the time. Now, Guardians had already come out. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the first MCU that had that lighter feel to it. But I think its lightness combined with its kind of mischievousness, I think, made it stand out more then than it does now. Mm-hmm. I think one of the issues they ran into with this film is that they are heavily relying on the charisma of the Paul Rudd performance, which I agree is charismatic.
And Linda, he is kind of a Baldwin.
He is kind of
a compliment that has traveled fully intact from 1995.
Look,
with no loss of value.
I am a Paul Rudd person. I like him in just about everything. And I liked him in the first one, and I like him in the second one. But I think they are leaning too hard on that performance, along with they clearly know that Michael Peña was the breakout of Ant-Man. So Michael Peña here is back with T.I. and David Dast Malkian as Paul Rudd's buddies. And they're very funny. I enjoy them.
Those are their character names.
Yeah. I enjoy them a lot. There's a little bit about Baba Yaga that I think is very funny. I liked them. And they go back to Peña doing pretty much exactly the same thing, in some cases exactly the same thing, that he did to great effect in the first one. But I think now they're relying a little too heavily on those performances.
Yeah, let me pick up on that. I went back and watched the first Ant-Man a couple days ago, and it's light and slight, but it's smart about its slightness. They cast Paul Rudd knowing that he's going to put his ruddiness all over everything and lighten the tone and toss off jokes. So they captured something with that. Not lightning in a bottle, because it wasn't nearly as dramatic as that, but like static electricity in a bottle.
Sure.
We saw this in a press screening, and the jokes, especially in the first half, were kind of coming like this, not creating a lot of laughter, but you can't really go by that. So I want to be careful here, because maybe they've made the film thinking that the reaction is going to be bigger, so that's why the jokes
are a little slower, because they're waiting for
reaction. So it's possible that these jokes will work and land in a crowd of normals.
But you felt that the pacing was too slow.
I felt like there was it was chugging, and then when we meet the character of Ghost and get her backstory, the film stops dead.
Oh boy,
for a long time.
That's not a good exposition scene.
Well, I'll stand up for that a little bit. I mean, yes, the exposition from her is poorly handled. Now, there's other exposition in this film that's kind of delivered in a drunk history style, where one character is telling, and that works great. I think that's a very funny bit. I sort of like that Ghost isn't. I mean, she's done evil deeds, right? But I mean, she just wants to fix her weird molecular condition. She doesn't have some sinister motive beyond that.
But I feel like what you have in superhero movies is two kinds of bad guys, right? You'll either have the sort of ordinary, mundane bad guy, or you'll have the kind of more poetic, operatic type of bad guy who fundamentally you are to feel bad for and who may show up in another movie as a non-bad guy. Right. I think that's a tradition in these films. What they do in this movie is they put both in there.
Yeah.
You have Ghost, who is the more operatic, sad story bad guy. And then you also have this character played by Walton Goggins, who's a much more down-to-earth
mercenary
kind of mercenary bad guy. I don't think either one of those is fully developed. What do you think, Thompson?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I also think, you know, in a lot of the exposition, you always have a certain amount of, Linda, you've talked about there's a box, everybody wants the box. There is some literal everybody's going after a box that is being carried around. But there is also just endless droning technobabble, more so I even think than usual. The number of times the word quantum comes up, the voyages into the quantum realm.
You got to adjust the refractors on your regulator.
I want to
out Glenn Weldon as having asked me if that was fracinators, and I so wish it was fracinators, but I had to tell him it was refractors.
It might as well have been fracinators. Yeah. I'm sure they had consultants who gave them like a vague Cliff's Notes version of how some of this non-science science would work.
If Edgar Wright had gotten to make Ant-Man as he was supposed to, it would have been fracinators.
And if you go back and listen to the show that we did about Ant-Man, one of the things we talked about was how much we appreciated the fact that the science part was very condensed. Yeah. So that basically all Michael Douglas said was, I put the atoms closer together, the molecules closer together. Put the molecules closer together. Period. That's how I made small people. That's how I made everything able to get bigger or smaller. Made everything closer together. Fine.
Worked for
me. Fine. Don't need any more. But as you might have expected from the first one, you come into this one spending a lot of time talking about this quantum realm, which is if you go subatomic, you get dumped into the quantum realm. Come on.
But we do get Paul Rudd reacting to that every time someone says something like that. I mean, at one point, I think he actually says, hey, do you just put the word quantum in front of everything you say?
Yeah.
And, you know, or he keeps trying to do the, oh, yeah, that was what I was thinking it was, you know, every time someone says something impenetrable.
But that kind of hand waving could have also happened without something like 15 minutes of this movie's running time just going to reciting the babble.
It's the rare Marvel movie that isn't 2 hours and 20 minutes long, but it's still too long.
Yeah, well, and I think that what they did is they saw the way that the humor worked in the first one and the way the performances worked, as I was mentioning, and they really underwrote the story in this one for me. In the first one, it's funny, but it's also a story that just makes a lot of sense. He is trying to get out of his life of petty crime. He wants to be able to support his daughter, and he gets pulled into this scheme. In the second one, it's much more complicated and it's much weirder, and there's a much more abstract quantum-y goal that everybody's trying to get
now
to.
Now you're doing it.
And I also think that, you know, I read an interview with Peyton Reed, the director, where he said this movie is almost as much about Hope, the Wasp, as it is about him. And I think that means the problem that started in Ant-Man and continues here, which is that that is a badly underwritten role.
Yes.
Is a bigger problem here than it was in the first one. I think Lily is good. I don't think it's her fault, but I think the character continues to be really underwritten. I think her action stuff's okay. Mm-hmm. I think she's doing what she can, but I don't think that they've put nearly enough personality into that character.
When she's given a chance to be funny, I wasn't necessarily looking forward to it because I remember her from Lost as being kind of a humorless character. There's a moment in that scene we talked about where we get a lot of backstory through the Michael Pena people talking in different modes, and she's great. She's like, oh, where is she? Where is this person? Because this person is having fun, and the character of Hope is somebody who doesn't have a lot of fun, and so that kind of conveys through her performance.
And I think that dourness extends to the Michael Douglas performance.
Yeah, which that's strange, too.
He just felt like a grump. Like, the actor wasn't having fun in the movie, and that, I think, carried through to
He kind of seems like he's retired already.
In the first one, I was so happy to see Michael Douglas be funny, as he is in, like, particularly The American President, which is what I said at the time. But in this one, I think they go back to a much heavier. He spends a lot of time kind of doing a very classic old man thinking about his lost, you know, loves and all that. And it's just not, I don't think it's effective. Another thing I do want to talk about, though, a little bit is they do a lot less of the people in miniature in this film than they did in the first one. In the first one, you had a lot of those, like him surfing on a bunch of ants and him.
There's like a bathtub drain escape.
Yeah, and I think this one has a lot less of that. Now, I didn't particularly love that stuff in the first one, so I'm okay with the fact that they had less of it, but they seem to change the superpower here from I can be really small to, first of all, a combination of small and big, which is fine, but also appearing and disappearing seems to be more what the superpower is.
One thing this film has that the first one did not is Michelle Pfeiffer in a white wig and fingerless gloves for some reason.
playing a character who's sort of returning to the story after being gone in the
first one. And I think this is the first time that Michelle Pfeiffer and Michael Douglas have shared the screen, which sounds impossible, but it is.
Yeah.
This is an air conditioning movie.
Yeah.
You know, and we talked about that a little bit with the latest Jurassic World movie of like, if it's 96 degrees and humid outside, I will go back to this movie.
Yeah.
It is not a movie that I did not enjoy, right? That's, I feel not quite like I can
put
say like,
ooh,
I really enjoyed it. It's not that I sat there and was like, ugh, this is, you know, because it's fun. It's these people. There's some good jokes. There really are some good jokes. Mm-hmm. I think it falls short of what I want. And maybe now my standard for a fun, funny Marvel movie is Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Anyway. I am sure that many of you will watch Ant-Man, air-conditioned or not, and you can come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and tell us what you thought. When we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Hotel Tonight, an app that makes it easy to book awesome hotels at amazing rates. They're basically a matchmaker between top-rated hotels that have unsold rooms and people who want to book those rooms. And even though the name's Hotel Tonight, you can actually book in advance. To start scoring great deals at hotels you actually want to stay at, download the Hotel Tonight app now. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa, the mattress with over 11,000 five-star reviews and a mission to end bedlessness in America. The Lisa mattress was designed to provide support and pressure relief to every body type and sleep style for a deeper night's sleep. Lisa plants a tree for every order and donates a mattress for every 10 sold. Get $125 off, free shipping, and 100 nights to try the Lisa mattress. Go to leesa.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Steve and Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Season 2 of Glow just hit Netflix last week, and I'm going to be dipping into it slowly. I'm going to try to portion it out to myself, but I'm really excited about revisiting those characters, not just the Alison Brie and Marc Maron characters who form so much of the basis of this show, but the supporting cast of women wrestlers I found so interesting and a little underutilized in season one. They managed to put together this really diverse and interesting cast and then just mixed in lots of like action sequences. And the first season kind of set the table for all these characters. And I'm excited about a season where we just get to live with them for a while. 10 30-minute episodes is just a really nice dose of a bunch of characters that I really enjoy wrestling and fighting and stirring up trouble. So yeah. I'm enjoying that as a piece of summer programming and just a little way to get lost on TV for a while.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson, second season of GLOW. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
In a previous episode, when I mentioned Bubble, I mentioned that I was on the lookout for serialized fictional podcasts, which are also funny because I wasn't finding a lot of them. And I heard from many listeners who made recommendations, and I checked out just about all of them. The one that they recommended the most was easily Wooden Overcoats. So I spent the weekend puttering around listening to all three seasons, and I am in. Oh boy, this is great. I am in love. It's set on the tiny fictional island of Piffling in the English Channel and in a village where there's only one of everything, including a funeral home run by a pair of twins, Rudyard and Antigone. And in the first episode, a rival funeral home opens up, which sets Rudyard off. Now, that turns out to be a pretty easy thing to do because he's got a lot of Basil Fawlty in his DNA.
Okay.
He's a creature of seething resentment for whom nothing goes right, which only fuels more seething resentment. So the setting is charming, the dialogue is very fast and funny, and the characters are incredibly well-defined. Rudyard in particular, there is a moment. My favorite detail from the entire series was something I did not notice until like two seasons in, which is that whenever Rudyard answers the phone, he does not say hello, he says, "Now look here." And that's it. That is literally how he greets the world. And it is just every time, and I notice it only slowly, but now that I notice, I look forward to a phone ringing on the show. It is great. It's called Wooden Overcoats.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon, and thank you, listeners, who keep us in the know. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Well, Linda, if I may be permitted a gross pun, there are multiple points of entry into the James Bond franchise.
Oh, boy.
And for me, obviously, it's the fashion. It is the only action franchise that shares my personal commitment to sartorial excellence, to making my, particularly my fall wardrobe, well, really my formal fall wardrobe pop. Which is why I was so happy to discover the YouTube channel of a pomade-haired gentleman who calls himself The Cavalier. But that is how I happened upon his delightful video, 007 Ways James Bond Breaks the Rules of Style. Jess, could we please hear a clip?
Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan, and Daniel Craig are all guilty of the faux pas of wearing a belt with a three-piece suit. A well-tailored waistcoat should sit close to the body and lay flat, but with a belt under the waistcoat, there's no way it can lay smoothly against the body when covering the top of the trousers. A belt leaves an unsightly lump under the waistcoat, particularly at the buckle. Bond wears a belt with his three-piece suits at a time when self-supporting trousers were out of fashion. Braces, on the other hand, were seen at the same time as something only old men or showy bankers wore. Should you copy Bond? Don't try it.
Okay, so in order, the things that I love about this are his slightly narcoleptic way of speaking over the elevator music. You know, that coupled with the fashion shaming, coupled with the, like in this case, the willful ignorance that if James Bond is wearing a belt, it's probably a weapon or a grappling hook or something.
Uh-huh.
Come on. There is something very, very soothing about this.
Soothing is about
for me.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. So most of his other YouTube videos are fashion related. Some of them have some overlap with film and TV, but style shaming James Bond is how he found his way into my heart.
That is delightful. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. So what is making me happy this week has been around for a week or two. I am far from the first person to talk about it. And let me start by saying I have what we call the mixed feelings on the topic of James Corden. Like him sometimes, don't like him other times, find him very smarmy in some settings, do not watch his late night show regularly. Have mixed feelings about carpool karaoke, which sometimes I have really enjoyed and other times I have found really self-indulgent and ridiculous. Recently, he did a carpool karaoke in Liverpool with Paul McCartney. It begins much as many carpool karaoke's do, with a person with him singing along with some Beatles hits with Paul McCartney in the car. But it does spend some time touring around Liverpool, going to his old McCartney's old house and some other places that he's known. There is a place where they, you know, they go to Penny Lane at one point, visit some people. And it's clear that the locals are aware that Paul McCartney is in town. There's a moment when they leave a building and everyone is standing around outside holding up their, my least favorite thing, holding up their tablets to take pictures and videos, which is such an annoying thing to do in a crowd. But then they wind up in a pub where Paul McCartney does a sort of a little tiny pub concert, we might call it. And at the beginning in particular, there aren't a whole lot of people there. And it does become quite a lovely, charming moment. And it's funny to see him back in Liverpool, where, of course, they take great pride in him. And for all the spontaneity that this is supposed to have, there is a woman who I believe I saw dancing in the audience with a Paul McCartney doll. And wow. I thought, she probably doesn't carry that around all the time. So it's not clear exactly how staged this was and how they went about staging it, but it is quite charming. And I do, on balance, recommend the Carpool Karaoke with James Corden and Paul McCartney. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Chris at C.T. Klimek. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, that's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, drop by Apple Podcasts and give us a review. That will help more folks to find the show. And we will see you all back here next week.
Would you put on a sweater that once belonged to Hitler? Can Chinese zodiac signs predict who's going to be a great scientist? And what happens when you use a training method for dogs to teach doctors? Answers to all those questions on my podcast, Hidden Brain.